This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/sword.
This podcast is part of the Frog Pants Studios Network. For more information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.
The Sword and Laser Podcast, episode number 46. I'm Veronica Belmont.
And I'm Tom Merritt.
Ooh, I like that voice. What's that
Thank
voice?
You. This is my... I'm being very serious about this book club now, Veronica.
And I'm Veronica Belmont.
Or it could be my Anchorman voice.
Yeah, it kind of sounded like Anchorman. Kind of Anchorman, and probably also a little bit Dick Tracy.
Yeah?
I don't know why. There was just a hint like Dick of Tracy. Dick Tracy in
I'll
there.
Try to cultivate that.
Yeah. That's a voice you haven't done before. I like the early, like, detective guy voice.
Ah, yeah. Ace detective.
There you go. Oh, wow. We came full circle. All right. Well, this is the show, of course, if you haven't listened before, where we talk about several different science fiction or fantasy books that we happen to be reading at the moment, as well as the news of the week and, discussions going on in our forums at goodreads.com.
Or the news of the fortnight, if we've only done a show once a fortnight.
That's true. It has been a fortnight, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, quite.
That's 2 weeks, right?
Yes, quite.
I'm just making sure.
We will check in on The Once and Future King and The Princess Bride. You're not quite done, are you?
I'm not quite done. I am currently on The Candle in the Wind from T.H.
Seems to me you live your life like a candle in the wind.
Is that... Yeah. So never did that knowing. Come first? Is that like a phrase?
That was the Elton John song
I know that
I imagine yeah. must have been inspired by the T.H. White book.
Yeah?
Because T.H. White came like in the 50s.
Well, that's what I figured, right. But what did
And
that...
Elton John came much later.
Oh,
when he was
she up. Was the princess.
Yeah.
No, wait, that was written, that was the, never mind. Now I'm confused. That princess was written about Diana. Marilyn Monroe, wasn't it?
It was written about Marilyn Monroe, and then it was applied to
and
Princess Di.
And it was applied to Princess Di.
Yeah.
Oh, history. Fun stuff. Let's start with some quick burns. Oh, and thanks to Josh Lawrence, by the way, for making the sound effects. We forgot to thank him in the show.
Yeah, we should. We should thank him every time, because that was nice of him to throw those together for us.
Because
Josh
we are
Lawrence,
exceedingly lazy when it comes to doing things like that. Yes, sorry. He is also the producer of Bike Club, which I'd like to think of as our sister podcast.
Yeah.
In a way.
Well, that'd be kind of weird for me since my wife's on it.
Yeah. Okay, well, your sister wife.
I wouldn't want to think of it as a sister wife. yes. Well, steampunk. Shall we talk about steampunk? Short stories in the style of classic steampunk tales. Boing Boing Eileen Gunn reports last summer the immortal Michael Swanwick offered to write a story a day for 42 days of the Clarion West Writers Workshop if you donated $10 to Clarion West. And so 46 people sent money, four over the limit. Clarion West offered the final four either a refund or a story each, and courageously all accepted and sent their names and personal details. Eileen wrote four steampunk stories each in the style of a different formative steampunk tale, and Tor.com is now publishing them. They were publishing them once a day, and so they've all been published now. The first story was A Different Engine.
I started reading it. It's kind of interesting because it comes in the middle of the story almost. Like, it feels like you already should have been introduced to the characters, and then suddenly it just kind of throws you into the middle of the story. It's interesting, though. I'd like to read all of them.
Yeah, I love this idea. I'm very attracted to the idea of the steampunk. I'm a big fan. So
we have more on that later, actually.
Yeah, and I like taking I'll talk about this a little later on. I'm doing National Novel Writing Month, NaNoWriMo.
You are?
And I like the idea of taking classic tales and reworking them, and that's what I'm doing in my NaNoWriMo book.
Awesome.
Terry Pratchett's young witch comes of age at last, says IO9's Laurie Penny. Tiffany Aching, the teenage witch who stars in Terry Pratchett's latest novel, I Shall Wear Midnight, is sort of an anti-Harry Potter. We've heard of this before, the anti-Harry Potter. Seems
yeah,
to be
we
a lot of them
about
out
it.
There.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She's a precocious pubescent who gets to ride a broomstick and save the day, but the final installment of her four-novel series of adventures is not a jolly tale, okay?
Oh, no. These are quite dark. They have to do with things
like... Harry Potter
is
not a jolly tale either.
Oh, this is even less jolly. I mean, we're talking miscarriages and, you know, violent alcoholic fathers and, you know, basically her being like the town hedge witch, which means people come to her for, you know, midwifing and ailments and, you know, small household magics and that kind of thing. I'm assuming based on what I know of hedge magic.
And there's a simpering
which is extensive.
Named Letitia. So it's all very Pratchett-like, and anyone who likes Pratchett or even people who haven't tried Pratchett probably going to love it.
So I'm a little confused, though. I was looking these up on Goodreads, and it says it's number, 38 in the Discworld series or 43, some
Discworld
high number.
Is like some ridiculously long series.
Now, is this something that has to be continuous? Like, can I pick up at the first of the stories about her? Or do I have to read the entire Discworld series to know what's going on?
You know, that's a really good question. I have not read nearly as much Terry Pratchett as I wish I had. And I don't know what the accepted wisdom is on this. So we should appeal to the audience. There's too many for them to say you have to start at the beginning, but are there accepted places to jump in, or is it just whatever, just read them in whatever order you want?
Because I found when I was reading and looking around trying to figure this out, there were mentions of this character in earlier books, and I know she's been in, I think she's had four books after her, about Tiffany in particular, but there mm-hmm. were maybe mentions of her earlier. So I'm trying to figure out, like, are those necessary to read, or can I pick up at the first one that was primarily about her? You know, I'd love to get some insight into that from any of you out there who are, you know, big Pratchett fans and know
the
about
sword
this
and laser
stuff.
At gmail.com. Mm-hmm. If you are the Pratchett expert, let us know so we can pass it along to everybody else.
Yep. And then last week on IO9, there was an interesting article by Jess Nevins about where did science fiction come from? And it's a primer on the pulps. And
the pulps, baby.
Yeah. And I found it really interesting because we've always heard of pulp fiction. And I guess a lot of people assume that to be a genre, but it's really not.
I knew you were trouble when you walked in here, Belmont.
The word pulp is actually just the adjective that, you know, describes adventure fiction, and has to do with, you know, there were the slicks, which were like the glossy magazines, versus the pulps, which were printed on less valuable paper. So it was kind of had that pulpy feel because it was made of wood pulp. And it's just, they're all different kinds of adventure tales, like science fiction and even sports and mystery. And the author goes through this whole big history because they're like a, you know, total like historian about pulps. Very, very interesting stuff.
Yeah. And there's a lot of differentiation of pulps throughout time. He's talking in this article mostly about the early pulp fiction, a lot of which degrades. It's very hard to find originals because the paper was so of such a poor quality. Mm-hmm. There's also the pulp fiction of the 40s and 50s and even the 30s that was on a little bit of a better stock and actually had a paperback cover around it instead of a magazine, you know, paper cover. And holds up a little better. And I think that's the one people think of more often when they think of pulp fiction, because that's the one with the lurid covers. And if you go to a used bookstore, any used bookstore worth its salt has a little section of the pulp fiction with the lurid covers and the crazy names. I've got a big collection myself because it's just fun. Those novels are just fun, especially the ones where they take like William Faulkner and then they spice it up with some lurid cover or Ernest Hemingway, something we think of as very, you know, serious fiction.
I know. They were trying to get your attention. They're trying to get you to buy the pulp. And how else are you going to do that except for seeing the cover and being like, ooh, that looks intriguing.
Yeah, exactly. You could judge a book by its cover back then. Well, at least they thought, they figured you did.
Right.
Yeah. All right. IO9 also has their November calendar up. So as we are recording this today on the 9th, lots of good books coming out. The graphic novel Serenity, The Shepherd's Tale by Zach Whedon, Joss Whedon, Chris Samnee, and Dave Stewart is winging its way towards my house right now. If you are interested in Shepherd Book and his past, which is a little like, you know, what's really going on with the old Shepherd book, you'll want to pick this up because more is told about the Shepherd than ever was told before. Also, The Dream World of H.P. Lovecraft, His Life, His Demons, His Universe by Donald Tyson. Anybody who has an interest in the old ones will like that. Full Dark, No Stars by Stephen King is out today, as well as Virgo, Pirate Sun by Carl Schrader and Seed Seeker by Pamela Sargent. And then looking ahead, next week, or I'm sorry, actually on Thursday, the 11th, The Painted Boy by Charles DeLint. And then next week, we have something from George R.R. Martin, Songs of Love and Death, short stories. It's edited by George R.R. Martin and Gardner Dozios. Sorry, didn't mean to get you all.
But it looks like Ian Tregellis is going to be signing or speaking at Uncle Hugo's in Minneapolis.
Awesome.
Along with Melinda Snodgrass. And there's a lot of cons going on this coming weekend. So this show comes out on the 10th. And on the 12th, there's Anime USA, there's Austin Comic Con, there's Days of Ice and Fire, which George R.R. Martin's going to be at. There's Millennium Con, Omega Con, Ori Con, Pacific Media Expo, Tusk Con, Windy Con, Yule Con, Jizo Pizo.
Yeah. Jizo Pizo Con?
Yeah, Jizo Pizo Con. It's amazing. That's a lot of stuff. .com, also, Hawaiian Entertainment Expo. Wow.
I know a lot of folks are fans of Greg Bear. I know this from a few mentions on the forum. So Hole 03, which looks like to be a classic Greg Bear book, is coming out on November 22nd. So you might want to look forward to that.
And of course, this is Month of Walking Dead.
Oh, yes.
All new episodes of The Walking Dead every Sunday, which has been fantastic.
And even if you've enjoyed the comic books, there's new things, but they don't. It's still in the spirit, but it's like you won't know exactly what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
If you've read the comics, and if you haven't read the comics, well, go read the comics, but also watch The Walking Dead because it's an incredible television show.
Aren't you proud of me that I've been watching it?
Being a zombie.
Aren't you all proud of me out there?
I think you all should give Veronica a hand right now.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
For watching a television show.
A scary television show.
No,
I think
I
you
know.
Mean.
Exactly. I do mean that.
It's not so bad. It's scary. It's scary. It's a little,
did
it's
you
a
watch,
little gory.
Did you watch The Sherlock on PBS?
Oh, did I ever. I've seen all
Man,
three episodes.
What do you think?
Love it. 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 But I am so angry that I have to wait until next fall to see other episodes.
I know they're only making three at a time, and next fall they're only going to make they're only going to release three more.
Killing me, they are killing me.
I bought the DVD.
Aw, that's cute.
Yeah.
Why?
Because I saw the first one and I loved it, mm-hmm. and I knew I wanted to watch the next two. And then I missed the PBS airings. And rather than pirate, I was like, you know what? I just want the DVD anyway. So I went ahead and bought it. And it comes with some extras. It's got some little special features on it, little commentary and an exclusive pilot episode study. Little special on the making of sort of thing. So
nice.
Yeah.
Well, I was so upset that I tweeted about it, and now Felicia and Kyla and I have this whole plan that we're going to kidnap the actor that plays Sherlock and bring him to the U.S. and make him act in American television for the next year. I think that's a good idea.
Yeah,
right?
Well, then he wouldn't be able to make more Sherlocks.
No, well, I mean, for a year. It's going to be for a year anyway. I mean, I guess we can send him back when it's time to start shooting again.
Well, if you want more than three episodes, I don't think kidnapping him is the way to get that.
But I... Fine. Anyway, let's move on to something else that made me quite excited today. And that was this fan-made Ender's Game trailer that I saw on BuzzFeed. I could not believe that this fake trailer actually gave me goosebumps. That's how badly I want an Ender's Game movie at this point.
I would love an Ender's Game movie. It's one of those things like Hitchhiker's Guide, though, where you kind of also fear it being made because what if they don't make it right?
I think we have the technology.
Well, the technology I'm not worried about. It's the storytelling, because that is a huge story. And to condense it into a movie is going to take some clever screenwriting and directorial chops.
I know the screenplay has been floating out around there, hasn't it? Mm-hmm. Haven't they been trying to get it made for a long time?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's been kicking around. Like, that's why I likened it to Hitchhiker's Guide. Like,
yeah.
It's been close to being made for decades, I think.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's take a moment now to thank one of our sponsors. This podcast, of course, is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many of the New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook to consider is, Tom, what's your pick this week?
Okay, yeah, I've got to make a play for the audiobook here because, let me tell you, if it weren't for audiobooks, I would not have gotten through The Once and Future King. And you may be thinking, well, you know what? I've just got too much to read. I can't read The Blade Itself by Joe Abercrombie. But I'm on Last Argument of Kings, which is the third in the series. And I'm telling you, you need to read The Blade Itself by Joe Abercrombie if you haven't. And this is a perfect way to do it. Pop an audiobook onto your music player or your smartphone or in your car, hook up one of those in your car and listen to it in that spare time while you're cleaning the house or you're driving to work, and all of a sudden you'll realize what you're missing. So I say, if you haven't already read it, Joe Abercrombie's The Blade Itself.
Excellent. And I'm going to recommend for those of you out there who are into this kind of thing, book 13 of the Wheel of Time series, Towers of Midnight by Robert Jordan and Brandon Sanderson.
Our good friend. We had him on the show once and he seemed like a really nice guy.
Our best friend, Brandon Sanderson. I miss him so much.
I know. We haven't talked since the one time we ever talked.
He doesn't call. He doesn't write.
That's another good one.
Writing a huge series of books that needed to be finished.
You might be thinking, oh, I wish I had more time for Towers of Midnight. I want to catch up on the Wheel of Time and see what happens in book 13. Here you go. Check it out. Audiblepodcast.com/sword. I almost said the wrong show.
Hey, focus.
But you know what?
Focus on like this podcast,
show,
Tom.
If you like this show, audiblepodcast.com/sword. Get a free book. Try it out. No charge.
Please do. All right. Now it's time for some barrier sword, which is feedback from the audience. Now, of course, we're talking about Arthurian legends a lot lately, especially since we did actually read another story about Arthur and the Round Table, which was Myths of Avalon by Marion Zimmer Bradley. And I found it was really interesting, like the comparisons between the two books, but we'll get to that more later. But there was a forum thread started by Terp Kristen about Arthurian references in other books, you know, non-Arthurian books.
And yeah. Well, one thing to think about with Arthurian legend, I've talked a lot on the show, I know, about the historicity of Arthur, but there's an entirely different line of research into the origins of the myth, the origins of how it got started. And Thomas Malory's Mort d'Arthur is considered kind of the pinnacle of that, but it definitely was not the first.
Well, even T.H. White references that book.
Yeah. Before Malory, there were other romances that told the story of Arthur and Camelot. And in fact, Lancelot has stories that date back further than Arthur. They think that they basically took the Lancelot mythology and merged it into the Arthurian mythology.
Wow.
So it's not unusual to think of how you could take these sort of iconic characters and work them into other books and other allusions, because they just sort of seep into your consciousness.
She pointed out, which I found really interesting, and I can't believe I didn't notice this in the first place, was all the references or parallels between the Wheel of Time series, speaking of which, especially in the naming of the characters.
Yeah.
Like Morgaine, yeah. Moraine, uh-huh. Lan, Lancelot, Morgause, Morgaze,
Elaine.
Igraine, Tigraine, which is Rand's mother.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Kalendor, which is the sword in the heart of Tyr. And, you know, versus Excalibur.
Amerlin, Merlin.
Yeah.
Iguinelver, Guinevere.
Wow.
Tarvalon, Avalon.
Avalon, yeah. I mean, it's... Well, but what was interesting, someone pointed out, was that According to Skip, the Wheel of Time books are written to intentionally reference the myths of our world, the conceit being that they are our myths and their myths are our reality. So Rand is also directly linked to the Fisher King, who plays a role in many Arthurian legends. Yeah. He says, goes on, I find it funny that Tom Merlin is the obvious physical reference for Merlin, and also the name, and is one of the main characters that doesn't use magic. Mm-hmm. And he also goes on to say that the Dresden Files has a Merlin and references the Merlin from Arthur's time as well.
Yeah. So my National Novel Writing Month book that I'm working on is to take the Arthurian legend and set it in a solar system far away from Earth with a lot of planets and moons that are operated as mining colonies for an overarching corporation. And you essentially have the COO of one of the mining satellites, he falls in love with one of the operators of a what I call a corner operation, and he kills him. But she has a boy. The boy is taken away. You get the picture. But it's all translated into a corporate hierarchy with CEOs and VPs and mining situations, and the satellite is sort of the equivalent of Britain, I guess, in this. And I'm playing fast and loose with a lot of the mythology, mm-hmm. but it's really fun to have that path to follow and play around with it a little.
Yeah, I'm really proud of you for doing NaNoWriMo. I know you've done it before, but it's just I wanted to do it this year and I chickened out.
It's not too late. It's not too late.
It is too late. I'm already just do already about 10 days in.
Do about 2,000 words a day.
Okay? Oh, so much writing next year.
I know. I got to do my writing for today after we record here.
You are dedicated. That's what I like about you, Tom Merritt. And then we had another forum thread. I can speak English. Amazon's top sci-fi and fantasy novels of 2010. This was brought to us by Sean. And he said it's November, which means it's time for stores to start downsizing their Christmas displays to make room for Easter junk. And for people to start publishing their top 10 of 10 of 010, 010, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Sure. Well, no, 2010. There's a 2, a 0, and
yeah,
a 10.
The
so
10
you can't
of 10.
Say 010.
010 was my... I said that. He did not say that.
No.
So here's Amazon's list, and it starts with, should we go from 10 or go up?
Yeah, we should go with from 10.
Okay, so number 10, Kill the Dead by Richard Cadry.
Need to read that. The Fixed Stars, 37 Emblems for the Perilous Season by Brian Kahn.
Who Fears Death by Nettie Okorafor.
Yeah, easy for you to say.
Okorafor.
Dexter Palmer has number 7 with The Dream of Perpetual Motion.
The Orange Eats Creeps by Grace Krilanovich. Krilanovich. Why do I get all the hard names?
1,000 Kingdoms It Doesn't by N.K. Jemisin.
The Half-Made World by Felix Gilman.
Redemption in Indigo by Karen Lord at number 3.
How to Live Safely in a Science Fiction Universe by Charles Yu.
That's actually a very handy one. And finally, at number 1, Michael Ajvaz.
Ha-ha!
Golden Age.
Gotcha. I really want to read, actually, How to Live Safely in a Science Fiction Universe.
Yeah, I want to read that, too. In fact, I might just click on it right now.
I am adding it to my list.
My list of things to read.
Because Sean so handily linked each one to its book page on Goodreads, so all I have to do is click on them and add them. Very nice. Very nice.
Responsible posting.
A lot of books I don't know, so this is a good one to go by. I did Io9's list last year, so maybe I'll add this one. Not the whole thing, but I got pretty far, actually. So this will be a good list to try to get through this year. Maybe we'll pick one of these for our next book.
Sean also has a thread where he started about Charlie Strauss's post on steampunk. And I mentioned that I'm a fan of the steampunk earlier. Well, Charlie is not. Well, put it this way. He's becoming annoyed by the glut of steampunk. He says, it's not that I actively dislike steampunk. And indeed, I have fond memories of the likes of K.W. Jeter's Infernal Devices, Tim Powers' The Anubis Gates, the works of James Blaylock, and other features of the 80s steampunk scene. I don't have that much to say against the aesthetic and costumery other than, gosh, that must be rather hot and hard to perambulate in. It's just that there's too damn much of it about right now. And furthermore, it's in danger of vanishing up its own arse due to second artist effect. So what do you think? And it goes on.
It's a very long post.
Longer.
Yeah. I'm a little over it, too.
Yeah.
I'm a little over it. And maybe that's because I feel like I read a lot of it at the same time. Or not a lot of it, I guess, but I think I kind of overdid it a little bit. And I'm ready to get, that's why I was happy to get back to some real classic fantasy and some classic sci-fi. Because steampunk, I think, is a really, really interesting genre, but it's also very hot right now. You know, a lot of steampunk stuff is going on.
I tend to suspect that this reaction is very typical to having something that was beloved to you and you felt special for liking when no one else did. Mm-hmm. As soon as it becomes popular, two things happen. One, you're not special anymore because everybody's talking about it and you feel a little mad, like, hey, that was my thing and you didn't care back then. Why do you suddenly care now? And two, everybody starts doing it. And so he's right. You have examples of bad steampunk now, which you didn't really necessarily have before because not that many people were doing it.
Yeah. And one book that I've heard a lot about that Charles Stross has written is Accelerando, and I'm adding that to my list as well. This podcast is not sponsored by Goodreads.
No, but that's where we have our group. And man, I love our group. Our group is full of really smart, fun people.
Yeah. But hey, we should talk about our book. Speaking of which, I have not finished The Princess Bride yet either. I'm 48% through. Thank you, Kindle, for telling me that.
What's taking so long?
I fall asleep easy. You know me.
Oh, that's right. You're reading it in the. It's your last book. See, that's why it takes me so long to get through Joe Abercrombie, because it's my thing I read right before I go to sleep.
Mm-hmm. That was kind of my problem, too. I had to set aside the Joe Abercrombie for a while. I had to focus. Yeah. And in fact, my mystery book, I had to set that aside for a while, too, because it's taking me so long to read it anyway. I decided I might as well just finish our two books for the book club and then go back to it when I had a chance.
So let's hold off on The Princess Bride until you're absolutely finished with it. The Once and Future King is much more sprawling, so I'm glad we're actually spreading out the discussion over a few weeks. You're into Candle in the Wind now,
yes,
which means you've covered most of the book. You're nearing the end now.
Right. Do we need to read The Book of Merlin? Should we be assigning The Book of Merlin to our listeners?
I'm going to read it because it's included in the audiobook, and I feel like it's just natural to go right on into it. But no, I think it's optional. If you bought The Once and Future King and The Book of Merlin isn't included, don't feel like you need to read it.
Okay. Well, I'm going to feel like I'm done once I'm finished Candle in the Wind.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's fair.
You know, this book is very interesting to me because it started... One thing I wanted to talk about last time, which I forgot to mention, was it started so lighthearted and so much like a kid's book.
Yeah, then, I remember we were both quite a little annoyed by that. Like, this isn't
And then
serious.
The tone has so very changed. I mean, even just from the beginning of the second book, I guess. Wait, was it the second or third book? Am I in the third? Candle in the Wind is the third book, right?
Well, it's the third of the audiobooks.
Yes.
I think it may actually be the fourth technical book because you have The Ill-Made Knight and then The Witch in the Wood.
Yeah. Right?
So okay, The Candle in the Wind is the fourth.
So when it started with all the brothers, you know, and there's the cat scene and the unicorn and things started taking a very dark turn. You know,
I feel like what he does is he suits the tone of what he's writing to the age of the characters.
Yeah, I think you're right, actually. That makes a lot of sense, which is difficult because the reader isn't changing. You know, I see where he's coming from, but to change the tone so quickly in a book and, you know, you have to assume that one is not going to spend that long reading the book, hopefully. It just seems like a strange, strange choice. And I don't know if anyone else noticed that or if that's just me.
No, I definitely had somebody tipped us off to that earlier when we were complaining about the childish tone in the early. They're like, he changes that tone as the characters age. So I didn't make that up. I got that from somebody else, but I think it's absolutely true.
Mm-hmm.
And he also just sort of deviates off into little side notes about his philosophy. And sometimes I find that interesting. Sometimes I find it very enlightening. Other times, I just wish he would get back to the story.
Yeah.
So, you know, that comes and goes.
Do we need an abridged version? Is that what you're saying?
Well, and a lot of people are probably reading the abridged version and may not have this issue.
Ah.
I think my biggest problem is that I wanted something different from this book. It's not a problem with T.H. White. T.H. White is writing about England. He's not writing about Arthur. He's writing about England and the world and the state of the world, and he's using the Arthurian legend as his metaphor for that. This is what I realized finally when I got into Candle in the Wind. I'm like, this is about the world and specifically England during the middle of the 20th century. And so when he starts to talk about Mordred, it comes very plain that he's equating Mordred with Hitler. Mordred's followers are the Nazis.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not real heavy handed. I wouldn't even call Godwin's law on him, but it's very obvious that he's talking about that. And he brings up the communists and he talks about John Ball so that it's not so jarring.
Yeah.
He's not going to bring up Stalin or Lenin. But it's very obvious what he's doing is, and that's why some of the stuff where I'm like, wait a minute, he's mixing chronologies, he's bringing in things that were not medieval and putting them medieval and acting as if William the Conqueror didn't exist. And he has that whole long thing where he's like the alleged King Henry II, as if, you know, and it's not a consistent thing. Like, for instance, in the Wheel of Time series, where the world is entirely made up of our myths, that I could deal with. He just kind of plays fast and loose. And when it suits him, he just kind of makes up stuff and throws it in there. And so Arthur, I think, is supposed to be England. Arthur is a metaphor for England and not so much Arthur as a character. I think he's saying this is the Arthurian legend that I felt I heard when I heard Thomas Malory. And this is the Arthurian legend I want to be true, even though it's not.
That makes sense because he goes through all of Arthur's different ways of ruling, you know, from right versus might, and then into like the whole law system. And
right.
You can kind of see the progression of the nation of England throughout that as well.
Absolutely.
One other thing I wanted to talk about a little bit were the differences between the Arthurian legends, and you seem like the guy to ask. There's a lot of big differences between this telling of the story and Myths of Avalon, for example.
Right.
Like Lancelot, like why is he ugly? Is that something that was in the original legend?
No, that's a really interesting choice. Lancelot is always handsome as far as I can tell.
That's what I always thought.
I'm not 100% authority on this, but I even did a little digging today just to see if I could find any other references. I think that's just a choice T.H. White made to flesh out the character and really accentuate the sort of internal strife was like, Lancelot's ugly. And so he's going to have to get everything through his word and his deed because he's not going to get by in his looks. And that is one tweak to the legend that I actually do like. That T.H. White makes. He makes other ones that are totally inconsistent, but at least that one stays consistent throughout the entire thing. And it seems to work. He talks about how Guinevere knows that he's ugly, but loves him anyway. He talks about how, you know, people look on him with a little bit of fear because of his ugly, but he's not misfigured or anything. He's just not real handsome. And I think that's a good thing. I like what that does to Lancelot's character. I wish he had stuck to more of that. I like what Marion Zimmer Bradley did, where she said, "I'm going to write the Arthurian legend the way I think it probably was as a source for what Malory wrote." White doesn't exactly do that. He sort of says, "This is the mythology I would like," but it's still a mythology. And it's not going to be self-consistent.
And so then there was also another difference between, which I thought was actually a pretty big difference, was Mordred's mother. So in Myths of Avalon, wasn't Mordred's mother...
Well, this is one of the problems with the Arthurian legend when you try to say, well, what really happened is that all of these are stories. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, we could talk separately about the historicity of an Arthur. But when you want to talk about the interrelationships of Mordred and Guinevere and Lancelot and all of that, there's consistencies. But Malory's story is different than Tennyson's, which is different than the predecessor romance poems that gave rise to Mort d'Arthur by Malory. So whose do you believe? Is it the oldest one? Well, then Lancelot isn't necessarily even in Arthur's court. Is it Malory because he was the first one to really popularize it? Well, why him? You know,
yeah.
Why do you get to say that he gets to make up how it all related? White is definitely using Malory as the source material. That he keeps referring to him over and over, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Marion Zimmer Bradley seem to use Mallory's interpretation of the events as an inspiration, but changed things and then sort of indicated like it might have been later misinterpreted to be this, but this is what really happened.
Right. So I think those, in Mists of Avalon, it was Morgaine that was Mordred's mother, right?
Yeah.
And in The Once and Future King, it was,
It was Morgos.
Morgos, yes. Yeah. Morgos. The names change and then they confuse me even more.
Well, right. There's Morgana and Morgaine and Morgan and Morgos.
Morgan Le Fay.
Yeah. And it's like, well, wait, Morgana is Morgan Le Fay. And there's two Elaines. And
There's three.
Yeah, there's three. Now there's five. Yeah. They keep multiplying. Yeah, exactly. So it's really, you shouldn't get too bogged down in that.
Yeah.
Like there is no real Arthurian legend.
Okay.
Everybody can change it around a little bit.
Well, that makes me feel a little bit better.
If I was going to pick one to say is canonical, it would be Monty Python's Holy Grail.
I'm going to agree with you on that one. One of my favorite movies of all time. And then the little matter of T.H. White, and he seems very misogynistic. Which is funny because I find the misogyny somewhat, he references misogyny within his characters at the same time.
Yeah. Right.
And he says, Boar, for example, hates women, you know?
Right.
But then the way he treats
Boar
all these...
hates women.
Hates him. Hates them.
T.H. White just doesn't think they're very smart. He doesn't hate them.
I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's his female characters do not suffer well, which is one of the reasons Marion Zimmer Bradley wrote Mists of Avalon,
right?
Was because the female characters get a pretty short end of the stick in most Arthurian legend, and mm-hmm. she wanted to say, hey, I bet that's not the way it happened at all. Let's show it from the female side. So, and that I think makes T.H. White look even worse because we read Mists of Avalon
first,
and so compared to that, all the female characters in here are either evil or kind of dumb.
It's true. Well, that's pretty much all I had to say about this so far.
What about the Irish?
Oh, by the way, he definitely hates Irish.
Because he does the same thing to women that he does to the... Actually, he's even worse with the Gaels. Like, there's pretty much not anyone who's Irish or Scottish who is worth a damn.
And Irish women? True. Forget it.
Forget that.
Forget about it.
The Gaels are the source of all evil as far as he's concerned. And I like portions of what he writes. I find it very uplifting. I find it very smart. There are certain things about war and the nature of man that I think should be read by everyone. But when he starts talking about the Gaels, it just pisses me off. I'm like, you know, that there may be some bad Gaels, but you're just making it sound like every single Gael is just an evil bastard at fault. And Gawain is somehow, you know, the only one who even comes close to some sort of humanity at the end. But, of course, he has to get his head bashed in before he admits that.
Hey, spoiler.
Yeah, I know. Well, we know how it ends. Come on.
Yeah, you're right. Well, can't they just go back to turning people into fish and having, like, little fish outings?
I know. Now we miss the chuff.
Just turn yourself into owls and have a nice afternoon. It'll all be fine. Where's Kay to be the dark side for once?
Yeah, I know. Exactly.
When the worst thing in the world was Kay being kind of a douchebag.
And then we never hear from Kay again, except some odd references like Kay kind of pushed around the boys in the kitchen. Anyway, off the left.
I liked the Lancelot. I've enjoyed the Lancelot Guinevere side of the tale. I know you told me that the second book was mostly focused on Lancelot and Guinevere, and at first I was kind of not into it, but I've really come to become attached to the characters, which is probably a bad idea.
You're smitten with the ill-made knight?
I think I am.
The Chevalier?
Yes. I think I'd get along with him, except for all the God stuff. Not that I have a problem with God, but I just mean like the whole, like, I don't know. I'd want him to like me best.
It is the story of Lancelot and Guinevere.
Yeah.
Through most of taking the first book with Wart out of it. Mm-hmm. From then on, it is essentially the story of Lancelot.
And, you know, the one way he did portray Guinevere that I found kind of realistic was, you know, just that passion of being so angry at someone that you love. I mean, I'm not that I'm experiencing this now, because I'm not. But, you know, when you're in like
please
a...
Please don't
like,
misinterpret this.
No, please don't. Very happy relationship. I just mean, like, you know, that when you're so in love with someone, you're so angry at them, or you can't be with that person for some reason. Like, the way that he was writing her, like, fits of insanity, as they were calling it, like, I could actually kind of feel that. Like, I got a good sense of exactly how she felt at that moment.
In some ways, I wondered if it wasn't a little too modern, but maybe that's just because of the legitimacy of it.
She's out of her time in the book, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And I, at first I thought, like, oh, well, this is just a little too obvious. And then I realized, well, no, but I definitely have seen people act like that and be that obvious in their anger.
Yeah. Like, why won't you be with me? Why won't you pay attention to me? But at the same time, like, oh, but you can't pay attention to me. We can't be together. Ah!
So I hate you.
I hate you. I love you. I hate you. I love you.
She's my mother. She's my... Oh, wait. That's
very much like Blair and Chuck Bass on Gossip Girl. Very much like it. Well, anyway, I think that's all I got for today. Any other topics you wanted to touch upon?
No, let's just finish up with our email. We got a nice one from Charlie C. Extrepid on Twitter. Says, just started listening and rather enjoying the show. Still catching up on a few back episodes to get the feel of things. Somewhat shockingly found you scoring easy laughs at the expense of my nation's heritage. Yes, I'm Australian.
Did I make fun of Uggs?
I don't know.
Because, man, I hate those boots.
I don't know if we were making jokes about the Western Island of New Zealand. But anyway... He says, great work. Love a little mongrel on my podcasters and great content on the sci-fi and fantasy too. Well, so, but welcome, Charlie C. We do not hold it against you that you are the descendant of prisoners.
I think that's what we said. Is that what we said? Because I feel like we maybe made a prisoner colony joke.
Yes, I think it was that. And we apologize.
I'm sorry. I would love to visit Australia sometime. Like, that is definitely on my list of places. I really, really want to go.
Beautiful country. I saw Rugby World Cup in Sydney. I ate wonderful food there. I went to the Great Barrier Reef. So no knocks on Australia.
No. We knock on everyone equally.
Exactly. That's
equal opportunity knocking. Get it? Opportunity knocking. Equal opportunity knocking. See what I did there?
I see what you did there.
All right. Well, let's thank our partner, StickerFoo. Use the code SWORD1 and get 10% off the stickers at www.stickerfoo.com. That's stickerfu.com.
Yeah.
And, yes. And of course, if you want to reach us, the email address is theswordandlaser@gmail.com. The website, as always, is swordandlaser.com, and you can follow all our discussions at goodreads.com. You can get there by going to the discussion link on the website.
Thanks, everybody, and we will talk to you with a final wrap-up, hopefully, of The Princess Bride and The Once and Future King next time.
Thank you, guys. See you later.
Tales and reworking them, and that's what I'm doing in my NaNoWriMo book.
Awesome.
I'm glad you think so.
It's your turn to read. It has a T by your name.
It does. Where does it have the T? I don't see it in the A column. Oh, I wasn't scrolled all the way over.
No.
I see. Well then, Terry Pratchett's young.
Here, hold on. Pick up clean on Terry Pratchett.
I don't do so pick up Belmont.
Pick up clean so I can edit it.
Terry Pratchett's...
No, I talked over you.
Now you stepped on me. You should leave this in or put it as bonus content.